From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Today, a trip through the complexities of Cuba, starting with a look at racism.
As a Cuban black woman having a relationship with an Italian, it has been a great difficulty.
And lesbians in Cuba and their lives after the revolution.
If you even look gay, they would arrest you. At the beach, the police would come, open the doors, and take everyone away just for being gay.
And finally, a Cuban immigrant who speaks the language of hip-hop.
It's not easy. It's not easy in Cuba. So for me, to make an original hip-hop, a Cuban hip-hop, you have to keep your roots.
This and more coming up on Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Quédense con nosotros. Stay with us. A federal judge in Illinois has cleared the path for a lawsuit challenging a key tool of the U.S. government's immigration detention program. The judge ruled that the Heartland Alliance National Immigrant Justice Center could sue the federal government over the use of detainers. These are instructions from the Department of Immigration and Customs Enforcement to local police to keep someone incarcerated and held for review by immigration agents, often for an indefinite period of time. Mark Fleming is an attorney with the Heartland Alliance, the Chicago-based group that is bringing this suit. He's their national litigation coordinator. And welcome to Latino USA, Mark.
Thank you, Maria.
All right. So for those who are not clear, what exactly is an immigration detainer and how exactly are they used and to whom?
So the immigration detainer is the legal document by which the federal government, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, instructs state and local law enforcement to hold an individual for them once the state and local law enforcement are completed with any sort of criminal proceedings that may involve that individual. Since September 11, 2001, and particularly after 2005, ICE and the Department of Homeland Security have relied heavily on this document. It is the linchpin for all of their interior enforcement in the United States, and probably the most famous or infamous of those programs being Secure Communities.
One of the reasons, among many, that your organization decided to file this lawsuit was because caught up in these immigrant detainers are American citizens. I'm sure that there are some people who are going to say, no, that's impossible. The government ends up holding American citizens as immigrants, and there's no way for them to fight their way out of this?
The named plaintiffs in our lawsuit, three of which are U.S. citizens, highlight the serious constitutional problems with the detainer process, namely that Immigration and Customs Enforcement, in the vast, vast majority of these detainers, are not establishing probable cause. They're not doing their investigation ahead of time to determine whether the individual, in fact, is removable from the United States, and hence the lawsuit. It is leading to a lot of problems and in the process to the detention of U.S. citizens.
All right. So your lawsuit actually was filed against the government in August of 2011, over a year's past now. So what's involved and what's at stake here for people who are trying to understand how this affects them if they are citizens?
We want to live in a country that respects the rule of law. And so how it impacts U.S. citizens is their basic fundamental rights under the Constitution, under the Fourth and Fifth Amendment, and they apply just as much to immigration enforcement and the holding of individuals in that process as it does to the criminal process.
So if your lawsuit is successful, what would it mean in terms of the federal government when it comes to immigration enforcement in a state like Illinois?
It is a problem that is happening around the country, and there's been follow-up lawsuits by other organizations in other communities. The federal government has ramped up the number of people that they enforce and deport through the immigration process to 400,000 people a year. To reach those very high numbers in the process, they've skirted basic fundamental constitutional rights and have cut corners. And the lawsuit is effectively to restore the rule of law to that process.
In essence, you're saying that just because this person wasn't born in this country is not reason enough to hold them indefinitely without charging them.
That is correct, that they need to establish something more. We have a very complex immigration system. There's many ways by which an individual can be in illegal status in the United States. And there's also a serious complexity as to how the criminal justice system interacts with immigration law that would make some people removable and others not. And all this lawsuit is saying is that the federal government has to do an investigation ahead of time and feel that they have probable cause, that they will be successful, that this individual indeed is removable. It's a basic fundamental right in the United States that you won't be held unless there is probable cause to hold you. And that's all this lawsuit is simply asking.
Thanks so much for joining us on Latino USA, Mark.
Thank you.
Mark Fleming is the National Litigation Coordinator at the Heartland Alliance National Immigrant Justice Center. He joined us from the studios of WBEZ in Chicago. For news updates throughout the week, visit us at latinousa.org or follow us on Twitter. We are LatinoUSA. That's all one word. And we're back in 30 segundos. That's 30 seconds. So stay with us. It's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. And on today's show, we're taking you to Cuba and sharing some stories we've aired in the past about the experiences of two of Cuba's minorities, Afro-Cubans and the gay community. After the 1959 revolution, the Cuban government moved to eliminate racial segregation and to provide jobs and education for Black Cubans. But half a century later, many complain that discrimination still endures. From Havana, Reese Ehrlich sent us this story.
By all appearances, Yoama Ford lives a contented life. She walks out the front door of her apartment in the Havana suburb of Villa Panamericana.
You can go this way or right up.
Ford works as a translator and is married to an Italian businessman. That gives the family economic security because he earns a good salary. Her neighborhood is bustling. Ford walks to the Prado, the main street where, even on a weeknight, a local beer and pizza restaurant is filled with customers. But Yoama Ford is a dark-skinned Black woman, and that, she says, can lead to problems.
As a Cuban Black woman, having a relationship with an Italian, it has been a great difficult several times. For example, sometimes right here in the Prado where we just were, the police has stopped me and who is he and what are you doing with him and things like that.
They suspect you're a prostitute.
Yeah, exactly.
Black men also complain about racial profiling by the police. Dimas Castellanos is a Black Cuban, a former university professor, and self-described political dissident. Castellanos concedes that police don't beat up or abuse Black people, as sometimes happens in the U.S. But he says Black Cubans are angry when they face harassment in a country supposedly committed to fighting racial inequality.
Psicologically, El negro es el prototipo para el delincuente.
Psychologically, police see Black Cubans as criminals, but they really aren't conscious of the problem. I've been stopped by police several times, and when they ask me for my identity card, I always say the following: what's going on? Has there been a crime? They say, no, nothing, we just want to see your papers. So I say, are you asking me as a Cuban, or is it because I'm Black?
¿Por cubano o por negro será?
Esteban Morales stands on a busy Havana street corner near the University of Havana, where he works. Morales is one of the country's leading experts on race relations. The census indicates Blacks and mixed-race mestizos make up about one-third of Cuba's population. Morales says Black Cubans now occupy top jobs in medicine, education, and some industries. Morales points out that before 1959, Cuba had a system of U.S.-style Jim Crow segregation. Black Cubans couldn't even enter casinos or fancy restaurants as guests. They worked mainly as small farmers, domestic servants, and street vendors. In a matter of months, the revolutionary government abolished formal segregation and opened universities to black Cubans. Within a generation, black Cubans became professionals and middle-level leaders. Government opponent Castellanos concedes that Cuba's socialist system made racial progress, but he argues it hasn't been enough. Blacks and mestizos have faced more problems since 1991, when the Soviet Union fell apart, Cuba stopped receiving subsidies, and its economy tanked.
When the crisis hit, white Cubans were able to receive money from their family members living abroad. Black Cubans, whose families hadn't immigrated, didn't have anyone to send them money, so the old racial divisions reemerged in Cuba. So what has happened now to the people living on the margins of society? Well, we can see them. The majority of the prisoners in jails are young black men.
Cuba's new dollarized economy hurt blacks in other ways as well. For example, Cuba has vastly expanded tourism and set up joint ventures with foreign companies. A University of Havana study shows that 75% of the top jobs in those sectors go to whites, 19% to mestizos, and only 5% to blacks.
Existe presencia, pero la presencia no es high level.
There is a black presence in the workforce, but not at a high level or even in the mid-level positions. There's only a presence in the lowest levels. You see them in the cafeteria, in room service, as taxi drivers, and in the kitchen. But you don't see them as managers or leaders.
Morales argues, however, that while racism in Cuba remains a serious issue, it is far less pervasive than in the U.S. For example, black and mestizo students attend the University of Havana in roughly the same number as their percentage of the population. Back in Via Panamericana, Yoama Ford continues her walk home. She complains about police harassment, but says she doesn't face racial discrimination on the job or in other parts of Cuban society. She understands that the fight against racial prejudice will continue for many years.
I love my country because I like what I do here. Cuba is a difficult country, but it's very likable.
For Latino USA, I'm Reese Ehrlich, Havana.
Next, we take a look at homosexuality in Cuba. After the revolution, it was condemned as counter-revolutionary to be gay. In the years that followed, many Cuban gays and lesbians who were able to left the country. And even though there's more acceptance today, the experience of gays and lesbians who lived through the discrimination of earlier times is just beginning to be told. Von Diaz sent us this story.
I met Gloria in her apartment. Her living room is painted avocado green, the kitchen orange, the bedroom rust. She and her partner have lived there together just under a year. Gloria came out to her parents when she was 16. It was 1966, just 7 years after the Cuban Revolution.
Vino mi primera relación.
Then I had my first lesbian relationship. And I wanted to be upfront and decided to bring her home. I wanted to be a good person and explain it to my father, who I loved and I still love deeply. And I wanted to explain it to him. I said, yes, I like women, but I promise you I will behave. I'm going to get an education and this doesn't mean anything. And it seemed like he understood, but his reaction was intense. He locked me in my room for a year and they wouldn't let me out.
Soon after her parents began letting her out of the house again, Gloria got a job and met her first long-term girlfriend. But her parents and official policy forbade her from taking her relationship public. So she married a gay man to keep up appearances. That didn't go so well.
Teníamos que encontrarnos en un punto todos los días.
He had his partner and I had my partner, and we had to meet up at the same place every day. Almost all of the gays and lesbians had to get married because you had to. Society demanded it.
Life was complicated during that era in Cuba, and particularly for gays and lesbians. The police arrested people just because they looked gay. They also arrested people who hung out in La Rampa, a known gay and lesbian meeting spot. Some people were taken to jail, while others were taken to the UMOP forced labor camps.
Decir que en Cuba, que la sociedad cubana había homosexuales, era imposible.
To even say that there were gays in Cuba, in Cuban society, was impossible. Because if you were gay, you could not be a teacher. If you were gay, you could not be a member of the Communist Party. If you compare young lesbians now to those in my teenage years, I can tell you that now they don't have to hide anything. You see them on the beach and they can do things I could never do.
Getting housing as children grow and relationships change is difficult in Cuba. Gloria and her partner Anita are lucky they have a home of their own.
All she sees is the beauty in things. Everything around her is stars and bright colors and bubbles. And she showed me all of that. And she relieved some of the pain I felt.
Despite the obstacles she's faced, Gloria has a happy life. She's in a good relationship, and she and her partner attend annual gay pride events in Havana. Visibility is important for LGBT rights, but visibility can put you at risk. Gloria was able to protect herself by staying hidden, but other lesbians didn't have that same luxury and were openly targeted because of how they looked.
I lived repression on G Street, on 23rd Street, and at Copelia. I was always under attack because of the clothes I wore. And if you even look gay, they would arrest you. At the beach, the police would come, open the doors, and take everyone away just for being gay.
Rosa is una mujer fuerte, a term in Cuba used to describe what in the U.S. is usually called butch. She uses masculine gestures, sits like a man, and says she's only attracted to very feminine women. She says she's been this way since she was very young.
My grandmother would give me dolls, and I hated them, and I would steal my brother's toys. I had to play with boys instead of the girls because the girls' mothers wouldn't let me play with them. I was something strange. I was a thing.
Rosa's childhood was difficult. When Rosa was a teenager, her mother forced her to take a boyfriend to, as she said, undo her gay sickness, and for money. At 15, she began drinking alcohol and left home. She never finished high school. She says she had to sell herself in order to eat. But around this time, she also fell in love.
That was the most wonderful day of my life. I will never forget it. The sun rose, and it was raining in Havana. And I was in a hotel with large windows, and I could see the whole city. I could see the malecón. And I said to myself, I want this.
Because of Rosa's outward appearance, she stands out. She's never been able to evade detection, never been able to hide in the same way other women have. And because she stands out, she's had to confront homophobia head on.
Today, men respect me. But why do they respect me? Because I stood up for myself.
Things have changed dramatically for gays and lesbians in Cuba in the last 20 years. The Cuban Center for Sex Education is an official state agency that provides family planning and HIV/AIDS services, as well as a number of support groups for gays, lesbians, and transgender Cubans of all ages. President Raúl Castro's daughter, Mariela, heads this agency, which also provides gender reassignment surgery free of charge. Wendy Iriepa, the first person to surgically change her gender in Cuba, became the first trans person to be legally married. But despite the recent changes in Cuba, many lesbians, like Gloria, say they still feel there is a double standard.
Men just have more freedom than women because we live in a patriarchal world.
Reporting from Havana, I'm Vaughn Diaz.
Reporter Vaughn Diaz comes to us from Feet in Two World, a project that brings the work of immigrant journalists to public radio. Madre, que el tiempo tiene de enemigo. Cuidar tu hijo como fiera. Por verlo crecer, jugar, correr. And coming up on Latino USA, the sounds of Cuban hip-hop.
I use my language, I use my soft part to communicate and to transmit my feelings.
Artist Del Mari Diaz, that's coming up on Latino USA. Stay with us, no se vayan. Sense of love and affection, spreading love in every direction, cruzando lo con mi Colombian connection, making it last an eternal duration. Es a gozarlo with my chest IV, putting it down sweet and sincere. Es al amanecer, cantando con placer, one nation and one love, everywhere. Pega duro en la disco, pega
través del tiempo, unificados a través del tiempo. Trae el consentimiento, pega duro en la disco, pega duro a través del tiempo. Oye, unificados a través del tiempo. Trae el consentimiento.
You're listening to Latino USA. I'm María Hinojosa, and we're talking about Cuba this week. Here's a story about some of the emerging art that's coming out of the island. This is the sound of the new generation of Cuban popular music.
Mira guapo, llego alcance este calor que me sofoca. Llegando a la sierra, refresca mi cuerpo. Me entra una base guapa, sí, atanaya la roca. Zapira, vamos a echarla, vamos, mi chino me avanza. So easy, nada más te la pachanga, parece una banda. Si tú eres el que manda, llega mi flow resonando. Ando por la calle y es casa segura. Yema ya tiene ese mando, salvando la cultura.
Delmari Diaz, a singer, a street poet, a rapera, is one of the artists that's leading this new revolution in Cuban music. Of course, the past is not forgotten. Delmari and her contemporaries take the rumba and the son of Cuba and add in the sensibility and style of hip-hop, funk, and jazz. And the result? Well, the music speaks for itself. And we're very pleased to have Delmari with us now on the air. Welcome to Latino USA, Delmari.
Hi, how are you, Maria? It's a big pleasure for me.
I wonder, Delmari, when did you start singing? Because a lot of times people have an impression of Cuba as being so isolated. The fact that there's an embargo between the United States and Cuba, and your music is so cutting edge. So where are the modern musical influences coming from?
Yeah, you can be surprised how many stars you can find in Cuba. You can find in Cuba ska, drum and bass. There is a lot of different movement of rock and punk. And so everybody's open to new music all the time. That's what's happened.
Although I have to say, I don't know if I've ever heard any woman speed rap in Spanish the way you do it, Delmari.
Oh.
Cuando voy, vuelvo al alivio, no me pare. Voy conmigo, segura, salvar, curiosa, ajena, enajena. Y alerta, voz despierta, mala vida me enseñó las reglas. Ni underground, ni comercial, original, certera. Cambio fuera, majadera, nuera. Calla, no me puedo quedar, aunque yo quiera. Nací libre y placentera.
I think that there is more women rappers. It's just that it's not easy. It's not easy in Cuba. So for me, to make an original hip-hop, a Cuban hip-hop, you have to keep your roots. You have to try to bring to the stage, to bring to your music the feeling of your ancestors, you know?
Escucha bomba y entendedera abierta. Vamos juntos escapados de esta tierra. Y tú que no esperabas, dime qué esperabas. Dime qué esperabas, envolverme en tu lujuría. De los trenos a los pies.
Y no es pa' que te vayas pa' que huepa. Y no es pa' que te vayas pa' que huepa. Y no es pa' que te vayas pa' que huepa. No quiero que se vaya todo lo bueno que me alegra. Y no es pa' que te vayas pa' que huepa. Y no es pa' que te vayas pa' que huepa. Y no es pa' que te vayas pa' que huepa. No quiero despertar con flores y sin primavera.
There's something else that I feel that you've done with this CD. Anybody who's ever been to Havana knows that there's just a feeling in Havana, and you use a lot of the Havana Cuban slang, the way you talk, the intonation, the accent. You also, there's these moments when I feel like, particularly in the song Pa' Que Vuelva, where you have this very slow, romantic, but almost that gray feeling in Havana when there's a storm. And you capture that so much like you're with your voice in that song, Pa' Que Vuelva.
Well, it's because Pa' Que Vuelva is a song from my heart. You know, it's a very special song for me.
Si se hace pequeña la ausencia, la alerta, la cama la espera. No busca pesar, no creo en fronteras, no creo en quimeras. Resuelve problemas, yo voy a esperar. Tú sabes, esta negra no para mi vida, no puedo parar. Tú quieres parar, prefiero la suerte, mirarte los ojos, olvidar los problemas en ti, descansar.
Pa' que te vayas, pa' que vuelva, pa' que vuelva. Y no es pa' que te vayas, pa' que vuelva.
Nene, porque
se vaya todo lo bueno que me alegra.
No es
pa' que te vaya, pa' que vuelva.
Yo aquí esperando.
No es pa' que te vaya, pa' que vuelva.
Yo sé cuándo es.
Y no es pa' que te vaya, pa' que vuelva.
No,
no quiero despertar con flores y sin primavera.
I think it's part of my style to be also slow, to be, you know, smooth, because one thing that I didn't like from the hip-hop movement sometimes is that they like when women are aggressive like them. So what's the point? If you are a woman, why you can fight like, you know, like the guys do. You can, you know, perform it, you know, the same. It's different. So I use that. I use my language. I use my soft part also to communicate and to provoke, to transmit my feelings.
Me levanto, por eso canto, tambor sudando que rompe el cuerpo, raíz despierta, esta es mi lengua metida en la tierra, negra de cepa, negra de ser, busca la rumba, viene de tumba, que esta es la esencia de lo que somos, precisa la idea, estás bien alerta, mente despierta, juega la fiesta, que es más profundo, parece risa que ser la guerra, esa guerra, canto free, soy libertad, autenticidad, fuera la mierda, que esto no es suerte, es claridad, saco, me viste, voy pa' afuera, con soltura, premura divina.
There's something that you do with all of your work, Del Mari, that just feels so modern and yet so spiritual. You know, that's not something that you might necessarily put together with a hip-hop and rap singer who's a woman, especially in that song Espiritual Sin Egoísmo.
Espiritual Sin Egoísmo talks about reality, about the roots, about justice, peace, independence, and also talks about spiritual, how important it is to be spiritual in this world that is so crazy. I mean, I think the best we can do is try to fix it from inside of ourselves and try to bring our spirit to our life, you know.
Well, thank you so much for bringing the music and your spirit out there, Del Mari. It's really, congratulations and good luck with all of your work.
Thank you very much, Maria.
Del Mari Diaz's latest album is A Diario. For more information, go to our website, latinousa.org, and we'll tell you more about Del Mari's whereabouts. And for this week, that's Latino USA. If you have any comments or suggestions, pick up the phone and dial our listener line. It's 646-571-1228. That's 646-571-1228. Just go old school and pick up the phone. Our program is produced by Carolina Gonzalez, Deborah George, Nadia Raymond, Andres Caballero, Lita Hartman, and Michael Jones. We had production help this week from Michael Simon Johnson and Neil Rausch at NPR New York. Latino USA is produced by The Futuro Media Group in Harlem. I'm executive producer Maria Hinojosa. Join me again next week for another edition of NPR's Latino USA.
Latino USA is funded in part by the Marguerite Casey Foundation, dedicated to achieving a more just and equitable society for all, and the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide. Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at GatesFoundation.org, and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, recognizing exceptionally creative individuals. This year's MacArthur Fellows are at MacFound.org, and the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting solutions to prevent and end homelessness. On the web at melvilletrust.org. This is NPR.